be here. Is anyone here from Washington, D.C.? Oh, good. So a couple people who can keep us on track. But none of you were involved in these initiatives. I don't believe, unless I'm wrong on that. I am the former bureau chief for cancer and chronic disease for the city of Washington, D.C. And like others in public health, I have no financial entanglements worth noting. this is a very nice follow-on in many ways to the other two, or at least the last two presentations, because it's sort of a different slant on how to use a public health department. I'm going to walk you through some key steps of the logic model and then talk to you about the initiative and what we learned. Why target chronic illness? Chronic illness is huge. 100 years ago, we could all talk in terms of maternal fetal health and occupational health, and you'd cover most of the preventable or improvable causes of illness in your community. But now it's chronic illness. About 80% of all healthcare is spent on chronic illness. We do a very bad job. We never designed a system to do a good job with chronic illness, so even such basics as self-care are poorly taught. The examples are just legion, and no one wants to talk about it. We want to talk in public health about stopping tobacco smoking and not about the fact that only 10% of the people in Washington, D.C. with diabetes are capable of self-care, or that we have 100% error rate in transfer of information from hospital to clinic. Why work on service delivery rather than on primary prevention? I think we should keep doing all the things we've been doing. So this is actually a call for expansion. So I'm not saying that we should substitute working on chronic disease delivery, but it still is the fact that demographically we now spend an enormous amount of our time and effort on managing chronic illness. Most of us will live with serious chronic illness for multiple years. The average duration now of self-care disability is 2 years at the end of life, and that, of course, includes a number of people who are disabled for much, much longer. The problems that we face actually respond pretty well to public health methods. Thinking about epidemiology, thinking about changing systems, we've thought about chronic illness and cancer as being things that are largely under the control of doctors, hospitals, that kind of a delivery system. But it turns out that they really need to be systematically approached, and that if you don't approach them systemically, you only approve little pieces. So a person who really needs self-care support needs it across all the settings in which they operate. They need better nutritional support. They need the possibility of picking better diets. They need the community to be supportive of the things they need to do to manage their hypertension or their diabetes or whatever. And those end up being public measures. There's a lot of problem with equity. The inequities that underlie the Barhi Project are rife in chronic illness care. If you get diabetes and you're white and well-off and well-educated, you will live nearly a normal lifespan. If you have serious mental illness, if you have disadvantages in getting into a healthcare system, you can have readily 30 years or more peeled off your lifespan, and whatever end organ damages you get, blindness, amputations, and so forth, will largely be much less well cared for. And then, of course, there's the Willie Sutton argument. If you hope to move money around in the care system at all, you've got to take it from where the money is. And the money right now is in the care of these conditions by doctors, hospitals, and other parts of the delivery system. Why use quality improvement rather than just program implementation? At least in our area, all the stakeholders are socialized to expect that what they're going to do is implement a program. And they're going to take it off the shelf and implement a program, and then that's going to somehow fix things. And it's just quite clear that quality improvement methods are just so much stronger. That if you can adapt and apply and use evidence all the way along to keep guiding the model and figure out how to make it sustainable, you get much, much more impact. So UCQI, because it has more impact, and also using it through public health office, has the possibility of teaching a whole group of parties how to go about improvement activities. So a piece of what we were trying to do was to get our stakeholders to begin to think in terms of evidence-guided improvement. Why target reform geographically almost doesn't need said in public health venues. It certainly needs said in health reform. Health reformers think that they're going to fix things one doctor at a time, one hospital at a time, one nursing home at a time, one social service agency at a time, one home care agency at a time. And once you get substantially ill, you are tied to your geography. So you have to have all the pieces of the system work together. So if you're working with a disabled child or you're working with a elderly person facing heart failure, you're going to have multiple agencies, multiple providers all working together. And those people aren't generally going to travel a long distance to get their services. No matter how they're paid for, they're going to be tied to the services that are available in their community. So geographic comes very naturally to public health, but it doesn't to health reform. So if you look at what's come through in the health reform bill, they are focused upon provider-by-provider reforms, not geographic reforms. So these are some of the reasons why you would want to focus things geographically. These are some of the kinds of things that are central to reforming services for chronic illness that simply can't happen if you don't have a community anchor. Transfers of information from one setting to the next, guidelines that can achieve standards for a community, and advocacy. You know, one of the problems in our area was that you can't get diabetes self-care education outside of a clinic setting. Well, the only parties that can actually make that happen is some kind of political advocacy to get our Medicaid program to start paying for things in other settings. You know, that's going to take the kind of political thinking that requires a community. So I think the community has to set the priorities and goals around the categories of people who need the services, work cooperatively to achieve those goals, develop information loops that make it hard to keep making errors. These happen in every other developed country. So when you go to Scandinavia or Britain or Canada or Western Europe, they're just automatic. So every county has a public health endeavor that is monitoring its health services delivery and setting priorities and generating data and generating evidence and having political fights about what, you know, what gets funded. We have none of that. We have simply developed health services delivery as a cottage industry. So we have no locus at which to even have the arguments. So there's no place in my setting in Washington, D.C. in which you could really have the argument over where your priorities needed to be. So I think there are some possibilities. The regional health information organizations, area agencies on aging turn out to be an interesting locus. But one of the really appealing loci might well be local health departments. So this is what we did in Washington. It's called the Chronic Care Initiative. And our mission was both was all three of primary prevention, early identification of risk and prevention of disease progression, and taking care of good care of people who have established disease at a lower cost in a sustainable way. DC is a very unusual jurisdiction. We're a city, county, and a state. We have a dramatically lower life expectancy than all the areas around us and the nation, much more mental illness, much more diabetes, much more obesity, much more end-stage renal disease. It's sort of our local third world country. You can get to it by subway. And we have a tremendously wasteful healthcare delivery system, over the 70th percentile on every measure in the Dartmouth Atlas. We have no dominant healthcare provider, so there's not one party that can throw its weight around and fix things or stand in the way of fixing things. And we have a lot of language and cultural diversity. On the other hand, we have a long-standing commitment to ensuring everybody. So at the time this project started, we already had 91% of the population covered with at least some sort of health care insurance. We had providers who were fed up beyond their eyeballs with trying to take care of people in what they called veterinary medicine, where they could not take care of people across settings. We had many existing collaborations and partnerships, but they were all pretty small. I mean, two or three provider groups or maybe a community group with a provider group. And then we had the enormous windfall of $10 million earmarked by City Council out of the tobacco settlement. So we started a unique public-private collaboration, deliberately setting out to try to improve chronic illness care in DC. We set the aims to improve DC as a whole, to measure against the well-being of the community. Now remember, almost every provider in DC has at least half of their services provided to people who do not live in DC. And it was fascinating that on the whole they were willing to be measured against the well-being of the residents of DC, not the citizens. We have a very strong commitment to it being the residents of DC. We, like many of you, have lots of people who are not citizens. we're aiming to develop a dashboard of measures, develop a learning organization, and make it sustainable. So we provided the initial project funding. We funded other interested parties. We provided contractors. There was no staff. There was no possibility of spending any of that $10 million within the Department of Health. So we created some contracts to provide infrastructure support outside of the Department of Health. And we created the Chronic Care Initiative Coalition, which continues. These are some of the kinds of projects. You might just look down the left-hand side. You can imagine the kinds of things there are. High-quality healthcare, self-care, focusing on special populations, transitions from one kind of provider service to another kind of provider service, and the health information technology to undergird it all. The initial populations targeted are in the middle column, and the total population that each project was expected to serve is in the right-hand column. So one of the big things that the teams had to start thinking about very early on was how to scale up. So when we funded a project to improve transitions from a 0% rate of information transitioning from hospital to community, a 0% rate in our public health clinics, the aim initially was a 10% transfer rate for diabetics alone to one clinic from one hospital. But the team had to take on the obligation of figuring out how to scale up to all of the discharges in the community for all the diagnoses. So right from the start, they were thinking about how to make this scale up. And scaling up turns out to require quite different methods than initial success. Initial success can often be bought by individual effort. Scaling up requires changing how systems work. We had a number of measures that we were in the process of developing. I think only a couple of them deserve real comment. One was to really focus on mortality under some age limit. So all of our measures, like the ones that were presented earlier, are for all ages, as if it matters just as much to die at 90 as it does to die at 19. And we pretty quickly came to the realization that dying young is different and worse, and that we were going to try to target the things that got lots of our people before they got to the age of retirement. And then the others, I think, are all pretty obvious, but feel free to ask questions on them. We also required every project to have its own internal measurement. This turned out to be quite a bear. The projects were not used to being measured beyond mere productivity, so they wanted to measure, you know, that they affected 100 people with AIDS, or they affected, you know, 100 people who needed screened, or something of the sort. And we kept saying, no, you've got to have a measure that guides your ongoing implementation and your scaling up. That took a tremendous amount of coaching and was only variably achieved. Some projects achieved it pretty well, but some were really still just floundering in the idea of measuring for the population. They would intellectually agree, but they would really have a hard time actually implementing the sampling that we would take to do it. We provided a lot of CQI support. We happened to have a couple of teams that were well-trained by Institute for Healthcare Improvement in quality improvement methods. We used that as an internal training opportunity. We did a lot of training in the basic CQI method. The idea of using time series was quite foreign. Everybody wanted to do pre-post or measuring against a comparison group. The idea of continuing to measure your own effectiveness takes a lot of coaching. We provided logistical support through a contract, that is all the kinds of things of gathering things, proving what you're doing, following up on contracts, because remember, we had staff that were fully booked on CDC-funded projects, and so we had to be very wary of just running this out of the Department of Health. This turned out to be very useful because it meant that outside parties had to learn how to manage this and ended up giving a substantial strength to the coalition. We had a second request for applications, which was somewhat disappointing because the applicants, which were a new set of applicants, none of the original applicants could apply again, hadn't yet picked up on the message. So it was almost like starting over again. But then in March of this year, the leadership in the city decided that they were not going to focus on this at all. They were going to focus entirely on nutrition and exercise and a little bit on smoking. And pretty much wiped out any further work on the project, fired me, disassembled the team, and interestingly, the funded projects got to continue to be funded. Interestingly, the coalition picked up. They had enough strength to get themselves 501c3 status. They're continuing to meet. They're becoming politically active. They have helped organize a number of the providers into what may become accountable care organizations. So it's too early to see if any of this yields enduring changes. The kinds of things that were clearly worth testing are things like a dashboard and public reporting for a geographic area that, in which people care about these things. Personal health records were clearly going to be able to overcome silos, especially for our seriously mentally ill, where you could put all of their records into a personal health record, have a service that would keep the password, and thereby be able to track very high utilizers across the system while waiting for Nirvana, you know, while waiting for the Rios to work. Collaborative quality improvement projects across providers where people were willing to share data and begin to learn how to sample from across multiple providers. Integrate CDC-funded initiatives with other funding so that we weren't quite so heavily dependent upon CDC funding for the direction and what it was that we were allowed to do. Deliberately build the locus of priority setting for a geographic area. This was terribly important. It was terribly important that certain leaders stepped up and said, we are willing to be measured against the well-being of the residents of Washington, D.C. We know that we provide services mostly, you know, at least more than half, to suburban people. But we are going to be measured by how D.C. does. That was terribly important for generating a sense of community. We standardized self-care support. That means a large number of providers started saying, here's what's going to be the core of diabetes self-care, and we're all going to support that. Providing education and support for clinical services in non-clinical settings, and testing changes in Medicaid. Some of our enduring problems were the reticence of the public health office to deal with clinicians and clinical providers. It's a very different power structure, and they were clearly quite uncomfortable. The paucity of data, the lack of analytic skills, the degree to which our local public health office has been decimated in terms of epidemiology skills, the lack of PR, public relations, and PR skills. We're in a very political environment. Nobody wants anyone speaking out except the mayor, and this wasn't the mayor's agenda. And no political push. I think the political push could come from family caregivers. We did. We added to BRFSS the module on caregiving so as to start building that political constituency. Having an organization capable of priority setting, maybe our coalition will grow into that, but you know, it's still a gamble. And the impermanence of people and priorities. Some of our insights that the chronic conditions improvements can be anchored in local health departments. There's a lot to do that. You can see some of these listed here. Some are pretty obvious. And bringing things to scale is still going to always be quite a challenge. I'd like to thank the Department of Health for the chance to try this out, and to the colleagues that worked so hard and the partners who pushed it forward. And I think it's discernible that in Washington, D.C., there's a substantially different spirit about the possibility of change on the basis of this little endeavor by the Department of Health. Thanks.
Thank you. Well, we've heard from Peter Jeschatarski. He was talking about measurements of models for preparedness. I'm going to ask all the presenters to please come up. We also heard from, Joe Balabas. He talked about language assistance services in San Mateo, California, followed by Selena Gupta. She talked about health inequities and how to eliminate them, some of the challenges we're facing. And we finally heard from Joanne Lynn. She talked about healthcare improvement needs as well as activities and some of the challenges that were faced in trying to meet those needs. I'd like to go ahead and open it up to the audience to ask questions of any and all of the four presenters. It might be something for someone in particular or something that you want each of them to address. Yes, at the back. Stakeholders, especially like to take that. Come on up here so that we can hear you well.
Go ahead.
You want to start?
I must have to think about that.
I know there's not an easy answer, but.
Yeah, I mean, as you've said, there's not an easy answer. I think that there is a maximum number of key players who can usefully work together. And after that, then you have to have layers of key players. So, you know, in DC, we have 600,000 residents. In the middle of the day, on a weekday, we have 1.2 million people in the city. But at the middle of the night, we have 600,000. So once you could get people to agree that they were going to be measured against the 600,000, then it was quite possible to get, in a reasonable size room, enough of the key players. There are 9 hospitals. There are probably 20 or 30 major community service providers. If you could get 3 or 4 out of the one group and 10 or 12 out of the other, you had enough to move the city without the mayor. I mean, the mayor wasn't going to stand in the way. The mayor just wasn't going to lead. There was one person on city council who pretty much ran, you know, like your board of supervisors. So if you could get his staff and these 12 or 15 people together on a direction, you could actually forge a direction. Now, you were doing it with no authority. I mean, it wasn't like you could actually say, you know, you're going to go under unless you do this, you know, or we're going to stop paying you. But it was really interesting how people, I mean, building on a little bit of regulatory authority and a little bit of, you know, money to seed some projects, the tremendous professional frustration with the system in which they now work was enough to fuel remarkable change. But I think you do have to keep it at a size that people can get to know each other and trust each other some, so they can forge some alliances. People can't treat one another badly once they've met each other over bagels. You know, they just, it just goes against the grain.
Thank you.
Let me go ahead and come up front right here.
Hi.
Come on up, Selena. The question is about the collaborative sample survey.
The collaborative partner survey. And I'm actually going to pass this question over to Sandy because I mentioned that there is a session right after this at 10:30 that will go into more of the details about the self-assessment toolkit. But she's been the sort of leader on getting this together.
Can you clarify what your question specifically around the collaborative partner survey was?
So, given the circumstance that we're not rolling them out simultaneously, what are your thoughts about how effective this has been and the challenges that it may pose for DPH getting people to buy into the survey? So we don't have an N of 5, and maybe get an N of 500 or whatever.
Well, for those of you, I will be presenting on it in a little while. We pilot tested all the instruments in one health department when we developed them in the city of Berkeley. So I can't, you know, give you a wealth of experience of how this has worked in the field. But I think our recommendations are that it doesn't really matter whether you do them simultaneously or one or the other. Obviously, you know, resource constraints are going to limit whether or not you can do them at the same time. But there are recommendations in the manual of how to choose the partners that you do the partner survey with. You obviously want to choose partners that you have a pre-existing relationship with, and they're varied. So you get a variety of different kinds of feedback from the different partners you have. They should be somewhat familiar with your work around health equity, because otherwise most of the questions aren't going to make any sense. And you know, we have sample communications as well of things that you could send out to start informing people ahead of time that you're going to be doing this. You have to also take into consideration, depending on your partners, if an online survey is the best way to go, if a paper survey is the best way to go, or if you want to completely scrap the survey concept altogether and maybe do focus groups, you know, adapting the questions to focus groups depending on literacy levels and such of your collaborating partners. Yeah.
I'd like to also think about, and maybe this is another conversation we can have, but to bringing in the people that maybe the organizations that we've worked with, but there's always been sort of.
It would be good to get the feedback about.
Absolutely.
Right,
absolutely.
Right. Right.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, in the red right there.
Thank you, all the presenters. I have a question for the person who leads me. I noticed on one of the slides you briefly mentioned collaborating with universities. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the specific role universities have played in the initiative.
Yes. So the question is on university collaboratives. Traditionally, in quality improvement work in healthcare, university providers have been very backward. It is ordinarily much more movement possible in community hospitals and Kaiser hospitals and VA hospitals, and university hospitals have sort of been the bastion of reactionary behavior. In our setting, we have, I guess, three university hospitals in DC. And five affiliated, but not university hospitals. And one of the strongest hospitals is not directly affiliated, but it is a training hospital. So it was a very, they were pitched in right from the start. None of them are terribly strong. You know, they aren't Hopkins and they aren't UCLA. So they were much more willing to pitch in and try to work on behalf of the city. I think Georgetown mostly held itself out. It sort of serves an elite clientele and keeps itself snobby, but the ones downtown that really realize they have to pitch in and figure out how to serve this population really stepped up to the plate. Now, not necessarily their leadership, but leadership of kind of key departments or key training programs would show up. Not necessarily kind of the CEO level, but and they were very engaged, just like they were community hospitals. So sort of flowed against the stream of national experience. And they brought to the table actually a good deal of both analytic capability and the willingness to do sampling and data collection. And they brought researchers on board who could handle those things at very low cost. So that was a real boon to the project.
Did you have sustained commitment from the university hospitals, or did you see a lot of turnover?
They were more sustained than I turned out to be.
Thank you.
Yes, at the back, please.
Joe?
Yes.
I just have questions for Joe. One is you had mentioned that you had identified five priority languages. Mm-hmm. Does that mean to the exclusion of the others or those that would remain focused? And then I have a second question.
Sure. The five priority languages are just based on the sheer volume of languages that were coming into our health system that we served. And so we had to make sure that there were services in place to at least serve those five languages.
Right.
But the other resources obviously are meant to help any individuals who come into our right. It just makes it's just that we tend to see a lot of Spanish, we tend to see of Chinese and all those other languages.
When you said your commitment to ongoing evaluation, you mentioned staff. Do you have a tool, and does that tool include your clients and other folks who would contribute to that evaluation as well?
Yeah, we do have a satisfaction survey. We do one-on-one key informant interviews with a couple of key staff who've requested services. Right now, we're trying to roll out a client satisfaction survey. It's been a little bit difficult because it's a matter of how biased the instrument is going to be and making sure that we get some honest feedback. I mean, and who actually gives the format? Is it the staff or is it the interpreter who does it and says, well, are you satisfied with the level of service that I've provided you? Of course, they're going to say yes. So, I mean, we're working with our vendor interpreter agency to come up with a little bit of a more objective satisfaction survey and a process by which our clients can actually fill that out and leave it somewhere anonymously so we can get some good feedback from our clients, but we haven't really developed one just yet.
I'll wait for you to do our work and then I'll come.
Sure, no problem. Anytime.
Yes, right up front.
I also have a question for Joe. Your coordination of this piece, was that a new part of the responsibility added to your existing position, or mm-hmm. is your position, was it added in response to this need? Are you grant funded or city county funded?
Yeah, there's a lot of backstory to that. Actually, the health department created a new division within our health department called health policy and planning. It actually is meant to kind of find ways to better collaborate and integrate work across the different divisions so that, and so it makes sense to house something like this that benefits all of the division in an office that's not really run by those divisions or that exists or is organized under one of those divisions. We basically sit under the office of the director, and so we manage kind of the strategic planning and programs that benefit all of the other divisions. So my position was created to handle two types of projects. One was language access, and the other was organizational cultural competency. So it was built in with those priorities in mind. And so having one person dedicated to those projects really removes the pressure and the burden on individual divisions to address those on a more of a siloed basis. So I think in terms of thinking strategically, that was a decision that our leadership made so that we can be a more effective and efficient health department.
Thank you, Joe. Well, I'm going to ask a final question of all our panelists. I'd like to know if you could share with myself and the audience, if you continue doing the work that you presented to us over the next 5 years, we're talking about the changing roles of public health systems and new advances, new measurements, identifying what's working, what's not. Where do you see the work that you are doing or that has been done? I know some of it has stopped. Where do you see it if it continues for the next 5 years? Where do you see us? What do you see the outcome? And I'm going to go ahead and start at the end with Peter.
Sure. What I see as sort of the outcome of all of this is essentially an evidence-based model that drives public health preparedness investment as opposed to the pet rock model that we currently have today.
Thank you, Peter.
It's interesting that we're in Colorado. Colorado has divided up its state into 7 geographic regions for Medicaid. Those effectively operate in the same way as I was envisioning for Washington, D.C., with there being an authority to make decisions, at least on Medicaid. Medicaid's a very big contributor. Those are likely to grow into accountable care organizations and at least take Medicare money and be eligible for shared savings. Once they're taking Medicare and Medicaid, I think that it will grow into the possibility of regional anchoring of decision-making and reform. So I think that within 5 years, with or without my little endeavor in Washington, we will see lots of areas that find a way to take public control of the delivery of at least serious chronic illness care within a geographic area.
Thank you, Joanne.
For us, I think we've been pretty successful in terms of addressing language needs in our county, but I think there's actually an implicit or underlying need for our health department to build its own capacity in providing that internally, and not just contracting that out, making more of an effort and a priority to hire more bilingual, bicultural staff and providers so that we don't have to rely so much on contract providers to do that for us. I mean, it is an expensive endeavor. And when, I'm sorry, the question that you were asking about costs, I didn't really get to it. Our office is actually funded by county general funds, and the interpreter services are largely funded by county general funds, but also a lot of it is through state Mental Health Services Act dollars that our Behavioral Health Services Division uses to pay for it. So if we can build that capacity internally and make that a priority for us, I think that's something that I'd like to see happen in the next 5 years.
Thank you, Joe.
I think as far as the work that we're doing, I kind of alluded to it at the end of our presentation, which is that getting more in depth about the practice by which social determinants of health plays out, and getting more information about those social inequities that exist within society, both from the perspective of within our local health departments and outside of what we do within the communities, because these are relatively unexplored areas and are very contentious, if you will. I mean, bringing up these issues and really facing them and talking about them are where we are today, which really needs to happen. I would really love to see also, our model is a regional model. And it would be great to have more examples of regional collaborations, perhaps in different parts of, California definitely, but outside of California, because I think that as a regional entity, there's a lot more power, a lot more that you can do, a lot more expertise that comes together than can happen at the local level with just one health department. So I really think it's a unique model, and you know, would be happy to work with people from other states about what this could look like in their jurisdictions, or at least start to begin to think about that as we move forward with this work.
Thank you, Selena. Well, I'd like to thank our panelists.